Yes, you're listening to the 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota. This is the Peace and Justice Report. And my name is Bob Connors. Tom Walker is here. Can you hear me, Tom?
I can hear you. Good morning, Bob.
All right. All right. And the opinions you hear today are strictly those of the host and the guest and do not necessarily reflect those of the management team, the board of directors, or any of the volunteers affiliated with the station. And I believe we're ready to go. With that being said, Tom, I know we have a couple of guests today who are going to be talking about Israel and Palestine and Gaza and a follow-up program to one we had about 4 weeks ago. So, Tom.
Yeah. Our first guest today is Brian Ellis, a real activist in our community. Brian was born and raised in Sarasota. He's an activist and also an attorney with a specialist in bankruptcy. He studied English with an emphasis in creative writing at Florida State University, graduating in 2009. After working in Sarasota for a couple of years, he studied at Florida State University College of Law, graduated in 2014. In his personal time, he likes to run, grow native plants, take care of his animal children, and community organize. He does his best to live with compassion, optimism, and mindfulness, an approach that he also applies to the practice of law. He was the founder of Suncoast Answer, which stands for Act Now, Stop War, and End Racism. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks, Bob. Appreciate you having me. I love the show.
Tell us a little bit more about your recent activism. What are you doing these days? What are your passions?
Really, right now, it's all about Palestine. Since October 7th, we've been having rallies in downtown Sarasota. We had one that was a march down Main Street, and we've had three or four more that have been down near the Bayfront. So that's kind of been what I've been focusing on.
Okay. Let me read from your Facebook posting of yesterday or the day before. You said Biden and Netanyahu are literally starving millions of people in Gaza and bombing tens of thousands of people to death in their houses for the purpose of ethnic cleansing. That's what I want to talk about. They're systematically targeting not only the Palestinian people, but also their culture, historical heritage, social institutions, and material basis for survival. Biden and Netanyahu and all of their underlings are Hitler and the Nazis reincarnated for the digital age with the genocide streaming live online. What a nightmare. That's what you said. Can you elaborate on that a little?
Sure. Yeah. Well, Israel has killed around 32,000 people in Palestine since October 7th. Of those, 29,700 roughly are civilians. 12,600 are children. About 7,000 are women. So the majority of the people that Israel has killed in Palestine and Gaza are women and children. And basically, the way it's killed them is bombed their homes and bombed the shelters and schools and mosques and churches where they've been living, as well as hospitals where they've been taking refuge. Israel's wiped out 60% of Gaza's homes. It's displaced 85% of the 2.3 million people in Gaza. And it's really just carrying out a full-scale genocide, targeting journalists, doctors, professors, poets, artists, really the entire civil infrastructure of Gaza, it's been targeting. So, you know, what we're seeing is a genocide, and I feel comfortable comparing it to the Nazi genocide of Jews and the Holocaust. And And I honestly don't even think it's a very controversial opinion at this point. I think, you know, millions of people around the world would agree. Probably the majority of people in the world would agree. And in the United States, there's millions of people who are demonstrating around the country and marching in the streets and holding sit-ins, blocking traffic, and basically trying to shut down business as usual for the purpose of stopping the genocide.
Genocide is defined as the deliberate killing of a large number of people from a particular nation or ethnic group with the aim of destroying that nation or group. And, you know, South Africa recently, a few days ago, took Israel to court, International Court of Justice, for violating the UN Genocide Convention. And that may take years to work through the court, but South Africa alleged that, quote, Israel has reduced and is continuing to reduce Gaza to rubble, killing, harming, and destroying its people, and creating conditions of life calculated to bring about their physical destruction as a group. So it would seem that South Africa, I would agree with you, they are the victims of apartheid, of course, in a previous era where they had to live in certain areas and were not full citizens, some of them. What else can we do besides the demonstrations, Brian?
Well, I mean, I think we need to put as much pressure on the Biden administration as we can, because it's really ultimately in his control. He is the one sending the weapons to Israel. He's the one sending the bombs that are killing these families and children. He's the one that's vetoing ceasefire resolutions at the United Nations that have the majority of the world's nations support. And really what we need to do is cause Biden to do an about face and do a 180 on his current position of supporting Israel, you know, for whatever it does with impunity. The case with at the ICJ brought by South Africa is very important because it's very possibly going to result in preliminary findings of a genocide taking place. And that is, even though it can't technically enforce that ruling upon Israel, it'll provide even more international legitimacy to these claims of violations of humanitarian law, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and genocide. So that's definitely an important case to watch at the International Court of Justice, aka the World Court. There's also a new case that has been supported by Indonesia and the UN General Assembly, that it's also at the International Court of Justice, that is charging Israel with occupation, and so that's going to be moving forward as well. And Mexico and Chile have just went to the International Criminal Court to have Israel as well as Hamas investigated for war crimes. So these are all important upcoming decisions that could add pressure against the Biden administration to stop.
I know Bob wanted you to talk about some points made by a previous guest on our show who was pro-Israel. He leads demonstrations in support of Israel. We had him on the show. His name was Ron. And he sent us a letter making several points. And we sent it to you. We'd like you to respond to to those any perceived inaccuracies that you see. It's an argument. In other words, it depends on how you see things, where you get your facts. And you, as I think you said, this Ron fellow got his facts mainly from the Israeli military. So go ahead and respond to, if you would, to some of those points.
Yeah, certainly. I think that our facts need to come from reputable sources and sound scholarship and history. So I think we need to look to the various United Nations organizations that have been collecting data and working around the conflict in Palestine. We need to look at Amnesty International's reports, Human Rights Watch's reports and findings. And when you look at these, it's showing that Israel really is carrying out a genocide, a modern day Holocaust. And so, for instance, you have the Human Rights Watch recently said that the Israeli government is using starvation of civilians as a method of warfare in the occupied Gaza Strip. Israeli forces are deliberately blocking the delivery of water, food, and fuel while willfully impeding humanitarian assistance, apparently raising agricultural areas and depriving the civilian population of objects indispensable to their survival. Right now, people in Gaza are starving. Literally, they're having to scrounge for, children are having to scrounge for animal feed in order to survive. Families are going without meals. They're going hungry, having to skip meals. So that's one thing that Human Rights Watch recently said. In 2021 and 2022, there were also really important documents put out by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. One was it was called A Threshold Crossed: Israeli Authorities and the Crimes of Apartheid and Persecution. So it was a 213-page report explaining Israel's system of apartheid. And in 2022, Amnesty International, that was Human Rights Watch, and in 2022, Amnesty International put out a report, Israel's Apartheid Against Palestinians, Cruel System of Domination and Crime Against Humanity. So, those are some examples of recent findings by these organizations.
Bob, are you there?
Oh, yes, I'm here. maybe it'd be a good time to bring Summer on.
Because I can introduce her. You can, Bob, if you like.
Yeah, why don't you do that, Tom, because I'm having a little difficulty reading here in the studio. Okay. So why don't you go ahead?
No problem. Our second guest, who has just signed on, is Samar Jarrah. I hope I pronounced that right. Samar is a Kuwaiti-born Palestinian-American speaker, journalist, and educator. She has traveled extensively through North America, Europe, and the Middle East, and has lived in Jordan, Kuwait, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and America. Her professional accomplishments include being a contributor to CNN World Report, news editor and reporter for Jordan Television, editor and reporter for Jordan Weekly, and a political science instructor at the University of South Florida in Tampa. After the World Trade Center tragedy in September 11th, she was asked by many community organizations, churches and temples and peace groups to speak about the Arab world. And these events and the Iraq War served as the inspiration for her book, which is titled Arab Voices Speak to American Hearts, a first step in fostering direct dialogue between Americans and Arabs. And I want to talk about that later during the program. She holds a Master's of Arts degree in political science, a Bachelor of Arts in Middle East Studies, and has authored two books in Arabic about her life in the United States as an Arab Muslim woman. Samar, thank you for joining us.
Good morning, gentlemen. Good to be talking to you today.
Yes. I'd like to just proceed, Tom, by I'm sure many of our listeners recognize Summer from True Talk on WMNF, our sister station. She is the co-host of True Talk, and I think it's been about 20 years. Is that true, Summer?
Yes, correct. Almost 21 years now.
Yeah,
I apologize for leaving that out. That's an amazing program.
Well, I want her to proceed and tell the listeners who are not familiar with the show what it's all about. And you've had so many great shows over the years, and I've heard many of them. So why don't you just before we get into the subject at hand, just give the listeners a feel for True Talk, and maybe we'll have some new listeners to True Talk on WMNF.
Thank you, gentlemen. The after September 11, so many people were speaking for the Arab world and for Muslims on behalf of Muslims, but none of them were really Muslim or from the Arab world. And WMNF was getting requests from listeners that maybe it's about time that you have a show that is done by American Muslims or American Arabs. You know, people at that time did not know that there could be a difference between the two, or you can be an Arab but not Muslim, or Muslim but not Arab. So anyways, I am not sure, honestly, how I landed there, but because WMNF was always looking for people of Arab descent to be interviewed, and I was interviewed maybe on the women's show a couple of times, and there was very positive reaction. So at the time, was Rob was the news director, and he approached me, and I told him my background is TV. I have no clue what radio is. And he said, no, it's very simple. Then he was, because I live far away from Tampa, I told him there is no way I can commit for, you know, a weekly show and a commute. I need somebody with me. And there were two or three gentlemen of Muslim background, and we landed on Ahmed, my co-host, who is originally Egyptian, but he, I think, came to the U.S. when he was 9 years old. I came to America when I was maybe 26 years old because of marriage. We started taping it for 3 months. And after that, we became live. And with technology, now, for instance, we are transmitting like you are doing, gentlemen, with the camera through my account on Twitter. We have interviewed so many people, but maybe Chomsky is one of the ones I remember, and it was New Year's Day. Chomsky didn't have many things to do that day, so he said, yeah, of course, I'll be on the show. Howard Zinn, Norman Solomon, all wow. The big names of, let's say, media. But again, we spoke to people from Lebanon, from Pakistan, from Kashmir, from India, from Palestine, from all over the Arab world. And that was maybe what was unique about our show, that I wasn't only Ahmed and I talking to experts, but also to regular people. We spoke to Jewish people, Israeli people, anything you can think of, Chinese, Uyghur. Whenever there is a conflict, we try our best to bring their voices. And of course, our show, we and the station were threatened. We received very negative letters, anonymous letters, where the FBI had to get involved and to investigate and see who is trying to really detonate a bomb in a nearby base. That type of fighting we had. And when we started fundraising, people would be jamming the phone lines, and then we had people physically walk into the station and hand in their cash and their checks, because even people who disagree with Ahmed and I still believe in the Bill of Rights, and they believe that we have the right to be on the air. So luckily, we had a very great board at WMNF, very great support from the staff, and they persevered. They didn't care. I remember one time a gentleman called and said, I'll pay $1,000 if you take these idiots off the air. Now, my credit card is ready. And they said, no, we prefer to be $1,000 less and keep these two people on the air. So it's been going on now for 20 years. Thank you, gentlemen, for asking.
Well, that's a beautiful thing that we're here in our 19th year. So it's a long time, but it flies mm-hmm. by. And unfortunately, during the course of that 20-year period, you have seen so much take place, not with Israel and Palestine and Gaza. And now we're at the point where it's happening again, and it seems to be worse than ever. Do you want to give your thoughts around what's going on now?
My gosh. Let me just like build on what you originally said, let's say about the Iraq war and how our show and perspective, I don't want to be bragging and saying always correct, but we warned people that invading Afghanistan is going to lead only to more destruction and more death, whether on the Afghani side or the American side. When we invaded Iraq, we said no matter how many bombs you're going to drop on these people, the human nature is always to resist occupation and to resist foreign intervention. And of course, people see that so many years later. Same thing we've always said about what is going on in Palestine. From my perspective as a Palestinian, whose parents and grandparents and hundreds of grandparents were born on that land, we were subject to occupation. When the State of Israel was created, it was created on other people's land. And the human nature is to resist, to try to keep your language, the way Native Americans are still to this moment trying to revive their original language and original religions and original culture. Same thing with the Palestinians. We are always looking to maintain our existence on our ancestral land, keep our language, keep our culture, keep our flag, our food, our cuisine. So to us, Palestine has been occupied by people who mainly came from Europe, because Europe was and still is racist and anti-Semitic and mistreated the Jewish people and is still mistreating the Jewish people and dumped their racism and their colonial legacy on other people who are the Palestinians. So I believe that we are two victims of the racism of Europe and the anti-Semitism of Europe. And most people who came to inhabit Palestine were from Europe or from Russia, not indigenous people of Palestine, because Jews have always, and Christians and Muslims coexisted on historical Palestine. Very few from Iraq, from Yemen, from Arab countries came to Palestine. But really, the bulk of people who came through immigration and before 1948 were European Jews who were persecuted by the Europe. And some of them are actually European Jews who tried to reach America, but America blocked its ports in their faces. Many of them went to Latin America, and this is why we have a vibrant Jewish community in Latin America. But some of them ended up coming to Palestine. This is how I look at it. It's an occupied land. Okay, it happened in 1948. You had the 1967 war, 1973 war. We are today. So what is my perspective? Me as Samar, I believe, especially after living in America for 34 years, it should be one democratic country where everybody can live there under one constitution that recognizes the humanity of each individual that lives on that land. I don't care if you are Jewish or atheist or Catholic or Muslim or what, as long as you identify with that land, then live there freely under one democracy, one constitution that recognizes you. This is my perspective.
Well, what do you think of that, Brian?
I agree with that. I think that the one-state solution is what needs to happen. One state where everyone can live with equal rights from the river to the sea. And I mean, everything else that Samar just said, I also agree with, like the history of Palestine as a predominantly Arab, almost completely Arab land with a thriving people in the early 1900s, late 1800s, when the Zionist movement began. The Zionist movement started in Europe, and it had deeply anti-Semitic origins, and the fact that there were so many Christians that wanted to expel the Jews from Europe, and who also thought that it was important for religious reasons that that Israel, that Judea, be there in Palestine, so that Christ could come back, and then we could have the, you know, the end of the world and things like that. So, the overall what's going on in Palestine and Israel is a struggle against colonialism and colonization by Europeans of a land that belongs to rightfully to an indigenous population of Palestinians, but over the course of the last century or so, or less than a century, you know, Israel has built a nation that now is for its continued survival has to constantly oppress and brutalize and expel the native population of Palestine. So in order to bring this situation to you know, a conclusion and to have peace in Palestine, there's going to need to be equality and justice for everyone, an end to Israeli apartheid, an end to Israel's illegal occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. And in order to do that, you know, there needs to be, I think, a one-state solution, because the two-state solution has become increasingly less likely with Israel's illegal settlements. So those are some of my thoughts on it.
Very good, Brian. Yes, and what about the United States' involvement in this? I think that's the big question in my mind and in so many people's minds, that the United States is more or less supporting Israel with so much, so many weapons, so much money, and it almost seems as though they want things to continue and continue the genocide to continue. Sama, why does the United States not play more of an active role in seeking a ceasefire and seeking peace?
I think the U.S. is fully complicit in the genocide that is going on against the Palestinian people. We are unfortunately not asking for a ceasefire. I think the latest emergency package was more than $147.5 million were specifically for the 155 millimeter shells that is literally killing the Palestinians on a daily basis. So we are actively killing the Palestinians, which reflects so negatively on the U.S. Globally. But I think, unfortunately, I believe that the U.S. Uses and abuses Israel in this relationship. It needs Israel to have dominance over the region because of the importance of the Suez Canal, the waterways, the flow of our fleets in this region. The U.S. believes if it does not have a bully in the region, which is Israel, a strong bully that can, you know, launch wars or defend Arab regimes there, this might open the door for Russia to come in, or China, and have more geopolitical involvement in the region. You know, the region is very rich with oil. So who is going to protect this region and the waterways? Supposedly Israel. So it's really a very sickly relationship where there is a very high cost is being paid, whether on the people who live in the region, whether on the Israeli people or the Palestinian people. And it's again because we still believe that we are a superpower, and we want to be a superpower and remain a superpower that cannot provide for its own people, for its own homeless, for its own healthcare system, for its own education, but at the same time wants to be a superpower and destroy the lives of other people and create hatred against us because of our policies. So our policies are based on power and accumulation of power. So if it takes supporting a bully like Israel, they will do. If it takes installing dictators in the Arab world, they will do. If it takes defeating the will of the people when they do Arab Spring or Arab revolts, for instance, tomorrow is January 25th. This marks the anniversary of the Egyptians when they went to the streets to get rid of a dictator and ended up with another dictator. We are silent. We do not talk about freedom. We don't talk about democracy. We do not talk about any of these things that we talk about when we talk about Ukraine when it comes to the Arab world. So it's a sick relationship. And if it does, Americans who are listening to your show, who listen to WMNF, who listen to Democracy Now, is our only hope. This is the only hope for U.S. to change its foreign policy.
Samara, I had a question. You wrote a book about how the rest of the world and Americans see the Arab people and Muslim people. Why do the neighbors of Israel, the other Arab states, why do they not either accept refugees or provide more support? Why are they kind of falling in line or being silent about this whole problem? It seems like they could be a little more helpful. But they're not. Can you
very good question, Tom. Let me start with the first one. Let's say Mexico invades America.
Yeah.
Okay. And Mexico is really planning to ethnically cleanse you. Because, you know, Texas and California and all these places used to be, let's say, Mexican, but they really want to advance to Washington and they keep bombing us here. And then we look at Canada and say, why isn't Canada taking us? Maybe because it is our country, maybe because it is our land. So the Palestinians don't really want to go to Lebanon or to Jordan or to Egypt, because when they did in 1948, although there is a UN resolution that says you can go back, they are still there And, you know, they died there, and their kids are still in refugee camps waiting to return to Palestine. So the issue, this is how the framing in our, like in the State Department and the White House, they try to tell you and blame the Arabs for not taking the Palestinians. Well, the Palestinians don't want to leave their home. They want to die there if they have to. What did Patrick Henry say? Live free or die. You defend your land, you defend your house, you defend your family, and you stay. And if you die, you die. So the idea is not opening borders to let more people be ethnically cleansed. However, where is, for instance, the disastrous Arab regimes come in? They are all not elected. They are all, except for maybe one or two, are autocratic, right, authoritarian regimes that are financed and ensconced in their power by the U.S. and by Europe. So look at our foreign aid. Where does it go? It goes to Egypt. What is Egypt doing? Closing the only viable crossing between an Arab country and Gaza. Every few days, they allow one truck to go in. And when questioned, they say, oh, if we do, Israel is going to bomb these trucks. So they are undemocratic, authoritarian regimes. And when the people try to overthrow them in Tunisia and in Yemen and in Bahrain and in Egypt, we stood with the dictators and not with the people.
Wow.
Let the listeners know they're listening to Peace and Justice Report right here on their own community radio station, WSLR 96.5 LPFM. And we have two guests here, Brian Ellis, who is a local activist, and we have Samar Jarrah, who is the co-host of True Talk on WMNF. Every Thursday at 11 a.m., is that correct, Samar?
It's 12 now.
12 p.m. Yeah. Every Thursday.
It's 12 p.m. every Thursday.
And I know you have podcasts, because I went on the website, True Talk, and you have at least 7 podcasts of past shows, and I had pulled up one on there was 3 weeks ago on January 4th related to the South Africa's petition to around genocide, and they had a hearing in The Hague back on January 11th and 12th, and I had said in my email to you I'd like to have you speak about that guest. And since that interview, the hearing has taken place. Do you have any thoughts on that situation?
I have just to make sure I do a disclaimer that I do not have any law background. So really, I am not an authority. If I am going to speak now, is depending on my memory with the interview we did, I think, with lawyer Huwaida Arraf on the ICJ, which is really... is an unbelievable development when it comes to the Arab-Israeli conflict, because we have been saying all along, not only Palestinians or Arabs or supporters of Palestine, but people of the south of the equator, the Latin Americans, the Africans, the Southeast Asia people saying, you know, you have all these international laws, you have all these court systems, but when it comes to us, when it comes to people of the South, you hardly use these laws to help us when we are being oppressed. So it is really very important that South Africa went to the international system that was put by the Europeans and supported by America, and use it in order to see, are these laws of humanity and these laws of genocide, are they applicable to people of the South? Are they applicable in the case of the Palestinians and the case of Israel? So it is really a testament, not only for Palestine and Israel and South Africa, but for the West, this West that has given me unbelievable headache about me being Eastern and being woman and being abused and have no rights and cannot have democracy and cannot have international law and cannot use law. Okay, now we are using it. So it's a testament for America and Europe to see, will The Hague, will these laws put forth by you guys be applicable to people who are brownish and people who are of the South? So what is this genocide? One, for instance, you have to have like five preconditions. If you have one of them, then you're fine. What is happening now in Gaza is really what our media is hardly covering, which is the starvation. And starvation is part of genocide. You do not have to kill the people in order to be doing genocide. You have to be doing certain policies that will lead to the death of the people. So what is going on now in Gaza? There is famine. People have resorted to grinding animal feed because they ran out of flour. They have no bread. They cannot eat. So they are now, the last thing they have is the animal feed, and they are grinding it to make bread. So you are starving them. But at the same time, another thing is happening, and whereas there is ethnic cleansing without actually shooting people and ethnically cleansing them. How? They have destroyed the healthcare system. So, for instance, in the north, where there is really the famine going on, I think 22 hospitals were completely destroyed. So you have two semi-operating hospitals. You have about 50,000 pregnant women in Gaza. These women, some of them are giving birth through cesarean section without anesthesia. How is the baby going to survive? There is no formula milk, so most likely the baby will die. These death tolls are not part of the daily tally of how many people are dying. So what South Africa did was showing the world that the ethnic cleansing or the genocide that is going on is not only going on through bombing people and killing them, because we already know 25,000 and 105 people have been killed, 62,681 have been injured, but on a daily basis, you have a huge death toll of people are dying. So according to the case presented by South Africa, where they have evidence from reporting, from things that the Israeli soldiers themselves put forth, making fun of Palestinians they are killing, or universities they are destroying, or schools they are bombing. All this was presented to the world. What is really mind-boggling is that C-SPAN, NPR, CNN, any mainstream media went silent on that day. And all of a sudden, the next day, it's 24 hours on covering live the Israeli defense. I have no problem with showing the Israeli defense. But what about the South Africa case? Like, how can you even follow the Israeli defense and their day at court if you don't know what happened the day before? So it's not only that our government is complicit in this genocide, but also our media. And there is just, I'm going to finish now, on if you go to the website of The Intercept, I think on January 9th, they did a very, very interesting study on how New York Times, Washington Post, and Los Angeles Times covered the first, I think, 6 weeks of the war. It's mind-boggling how our media dehumanizes. I mean, it's not only omission. I'm fine with omission, but to use words in a way to dehumanize the victims, as if we have not learned anything from history.
Jeez. Go ahead, Brian.
Absolutely. I saw a post this morning by Rosie Pirani, who's been commenting a lot on what's going on. And she said, the fact that Western mainstream media didn't broadcast South Africa's presentation of its case against Israel, or the largest pro-Palestine rally in U.S. history, where over 400,000 protesters marched on D.C., tells you everything you need to know. We should never look to Western media outlets for real news. And it's so true. I know that in the first massive D.C. rally, CNN said there were 40,000 people. There were actually closer to 400,000 in Washington, D.C., and there's been two major national rallies so far. Another thing is, as Summer was talking about, was the different aspects of genocide, and all of them in the ICJ case have been linked to specific statements made by Israeli officials showing genocidal intent. I just wanted to read a few of them. Israeli President Isaac Herzog said, it's an entire nation out there that is responsible. It is not true, this rhetoric about civilians not aware, not involved. We will fight until we break their backbone. Deputy Speaker, go ahead. The Deputy Speaker of the Knesset, Nissim Vaturi, said, now we all have one common goal, erasing the Gaza Strip from the face of the earth. The Israeli Minister of National Security, Itamar Ben-Gvir, said, the only thing that needs to enter Gaza are hundreds of tons of explosives from the Air Force, not an ounce of humanitarian aid. And then Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said, no electricity, no food, no water, no fuel. Everything is closed. We are fighting human animals and we are acting accordingly. Gaza won't return to what it was before. We will eliminate everything. And of course, there's other statements made as well, but it's just it's a clear open and shut case of genocide, because Israel has made it clear what it wants to do. So yeah, those were some thoughts that came to mind. And another thing is you know, how does this, Summer touched on this. You know, when we talk about Palestine, we're talking about imperialism as a world system as well. So it's not just a single issue. It really kind of encapsulates so much about the world, because you have the world right now is under the grip of imperialism, which is led by the United States and its and Western European nations that are its lackeys, and essentially, it's the most dangerous thing in the world, because if you look at Ukraine, if you look at Taiwan, if you look at the Middle East, U.S. imperialism is threatening to cause World War III. And then you have, like Samar also said, around the world, the United States is propping up so many dictators and authoritarian regimes and his allies to so many, absolute monarchs. So you look at Saudi Arabia, you look at, again, at Egypt. So really, when the reason Palestine is so important is, well, one, because of human rights, and the Palestinian people deserve self-determination, and they deserve freedom. But, and also, all the peoples of the world deserve freedom, including the people here in the United States who are living under this despotic regime, this imperialist regime that denies them so many fundamental rights. Whether it's housing or medical care or jobs and food, and it's doing this as part of a giant system of this military-industrial complex, where all the money and all of our resources are going to basically an enormous global empire, instead of helping people here. So it's just such an important issue for so many reasons.
If I may add, Brian, and build on what Brian said, some people maybe don't care about the image of the U.S. outside the world, but the rest of the people do care, and they used to care. And if you go, and because of course I know Arabic language, and if you go on Twitter and Facebook and read the frustration of the people, especially young people who grew up on our music, grew up watching all our miniseries. I mean, they know things about America, the pop culture, that I do not know. Their frustration to them, they tell me it has always been fake. There was nothing real about America. They sell us these movies, they sell us these people and these slogans. But it's all, when it comes to the Palestinians, it's as if they finally saw the ugly face of the U.S., which the U.S. invested billions of dollars to, soft power with our food, Subway, McDonald's, anything you can think of is in every corner, in Yemen, in the slums of Cairo. People now boycott everything that is American, whether it is related to the war or not, but they have such disgust of our policies. When Biden very, very proudly says, oh, no, we're going to maybe wait until the beginning of the year, there are people being cut into pieces. There are fathers who are carrying the remains of their kids in plastic bags. And we see all these images. Generation Z in America sees all these images. And I don't think the people in the White House and this colonial military industrial complex has a clue how this will have ripple effects, how it will threaten our national security, our national interest. Maybe not today and not tomorrow, but rest assured, some people, especially people on the fringe, will take this as a rallying cry and do terrorism and use it and abuse it, just like it happened with September 11. Because what was the rallying cry of Osama bin Laden? Okay. He had like 1 million grievances. And then he says, oh, it is Palestine and what is happening to the Palestinians. And I reject that. I don't want anybody to use Palestine as an excuse to commit terrorism. But I don't think these people have a clue, or they care, or they seem to think that bullets and bombs will solve the problem. It will not. It's not going to do it. It didn't work in Afghanistan. It didn't work in Iraq. It didn't work in Vietnam. It's not working in the Ukraine. So why do they think it's going to work in Israel and Palestine?
Hello, Samar. This is Alvaro, from WMNF some time ago.
Hi, Alvaro.
Yes, how are you?
I didn't recognize you because you're wearing a hat.
I wanted to ask you about some things that are normally that are in the air and hard to decipher. And I'm wondering if you can shed some light. It is often said or spoken about a Shia-Sunni divide. But we see in 1982, when Israel invaded Lebanon, Syria came to the aid of Lebanon. As I understand, the creation of Hezbollah, and then we have that, and then Hamas is Sunni. What thoughts come to mind when people talk about Shia Sunni divide? But here we see a support from allegedly from Iran, from Syria, which are Shia, to Hamas, which is Sunni. And I wanted to ask about that. And then what way do we have out?
We only have a minute left of our own, so I don't know where we
yes.
can go.
Right. And then a real quick thing. So what do we do now? We have Genocide Joe on one side and Fascist Trump on the other. What do we do?
You have the last word, Samar.
Samar.
She's muted. That's a good question, Alvaro. Maybe we can follow that up. The difference between Shia and Sunni is an important one, and it affects the relationships there. And we've been talking to Samar Jarrah of WMNS True Talk and Brian Ellis, an activist here in Sarasota. Any last thoughts, Bob?
Well, I'm really glad Samar was available to come on. I really appreciate all your thoughts and everything you had to say.